This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato wrote and directed the new film Party Monster. It's set in the downtown Manhattan club scene of the 80s. The movie's based on the true story of Michael Alig, who became famous for producing over-the-top parties in which people came in glamorous and surreal gender-bending costumes and got very high. But after getting addicted to drugs and losing whatever bearings he had, Alig murdered his drug dealer, Angel, who was also his friend. Michael Alig is played by Macaulay Culkin. Seth Green plays James St. James, who teaches Alig how to dress, behave, and become the center of attention in the party scene. In this scene from early in the film, they're in a Dunkin' Donuts. Alig is asking for advice.
What do you do?
I don't do. I just am extremely rich. Anyway, if I'm to stay in this Roach Motel a moment longer, we're going to need to take things up a notch.
I don't do drugs.
Nor do I. Did you see that? It just blew right up my nose.
My mother says drugs are for losers.
She's so right. The ketamine hydrochloride, aka Special K, is mainly used by vets as an animal tranquilizer. When taken by humans, it works as a dissociative drug, selectively reducing excitation of the central mammalian neurons by N-methyl aspirin. In other words, it f***s you.
I want you to teach me how to be fabulous.
We have nothing in common.
We both bite our nails. Please, don't go. I don't have any friends. I just got here. I just got off the bus.
The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. Blake, William, that's really all you need to know. That and don't dream it, be it.
The movie Party Monster is based on a documentary of the same name that filmmakers Bailey and Barbato made about Michael Alig a few years ago. They also made the films The Eyes of Tammy Faye, Monica in Black and White, and Gay Hollywood. I asked them to describe the club scene the movie is set in. Fenton Bailey says it was hierarchical and codified.
It was sort of led by Warhol at the top, and beneath Warhol were various luminaries of the nightclub scene. But it was very, very structured, rather like the court at Versailles. And along comes Michael Alig, this little kid that no one pays any attention to. And he just acts up and behaves badly. And his pranks and attention-getting devices actually created this whole new club scene that was based on chaos, irreverence, that ostensibly had no structure at all. One of the key Michael Alig things was to do these outlaw parties where he would call everybody up and everybody would gather at a subway station or under a railway bridge, and they would be there for 10 or 15 minutes, and then the police would show up and break the whole thing up. So Michael Alig's New York nightlife scene was based on sort of anarchy, and it came as this revolution after a very structured and not archaic, but Byzantine club scene.
The thing about Michael Alig's scene is, for a minute, particularly at the beginning, he was trying to create this sort of utopia. He was sort of creating a safe space for all these misfits and all these kids who were picked on in high school from all over the country to come to New York and reinvent yourself, be the life of the party, be the superstar. And I think that was very different than Warhol's scene and vision.
Warhol was more about exclusivity.
I think Warhol's was really the prophet of the times we live in today, and so much of what he said and did we're now living with. I mean, it's funny to think that Warhol created or talked about doing the Nothing Special show, which would happen and no one would do anything. Well, you know, what is Big Brother other than the Nothing Special show? I mean, he kind of invented reality TV. And I think what the club kids were doing was sort of, in a way, they're Warhol's grandchildren. And they were taking Warhol's principles and making them their own. And they did so very successfully.
Michael Alig did a lot of drugs, and so did a lot of people involved in this scene. What were his drugs of choice?
Oh, Michael Alig's drugs were like coke, K, rohypnol, heroin, crack, anything and everything. He consumed drugs really like children consume candy.
When it came to drugs, he didn't discriminate. It was funny making the movie because we actually found that we had to take out a lot of the drug scenes because it just became unbelievable. So in the film, to a certain extent, we don't we weren't able to kind of represent, you know, the vast quantities of drugs that he did.
Of course, the irony is that Michael Ehrlich, when he came to New York, and in the first stages of his career, was very anti-drugs. In fact, he didn't really even drink that much. And Michael was very contemptuous of people who had drug addiction problems. And his whole thing was to pretend that he was drunk and messed up, because that would get the party atmosphere going. And of course, at some point, pretending crossed over into actually being a mess.
Have you tried to imagine what happened to his mind that enabled him to commit a murder and then just dispose of the body a few days later after the body sat around the house for a few days? And I should mention, the person he murdered was his drug dealer, who was demanding to finally get paid because it had been a long time since he'd gotten paid.
Yeah, that's right. His drug dealer and his roommate and supposedly his friend. I think it would be all too easy, though, to blame the murder on the drugs. And for us, the murder really is this problem at the heart of the movie. And the murder was actually caused by many, many, many things. And there are, we think, in many ways, there are multiple truths that explain how and why this murder happened. You know, good and evil are really complicated things, and that they coexist in us in equal measure. And this murder, which is this problem at the heart of the movie, happens for many, many different reasons, and drug addiction is just one of the many reasons.
Michael was an addict, and drugs, and he was a drug addict as well, but I think his addiction to fame had more to do with his downfall, and is the thing to really look at here. I mean, you know, we live in a culture of celebrity, and Michael, you know, lived for the spotlight. It was like oxygen for him.
Well, were you a part of this club scene?
We were really more on the periphery, I suppose. Randy and I would DJ, and we had a band called the Pop Tarts, who we used to perform in a lot of these clubs, somewhat before the club kids came along. I'm afraid we're too old to have been club kids. And so we really watched it from the outside. We both had day jobs, so we couldn't lose ourselves completely in the nightlife, because we had to get up early and go to work.
Yeah, and it's like when Michael Ehrlich says to his young mentor, James St. James, "What do you do?" James St. James says, "I don't do, I just am." I guess you weren't just am, you were actually working.
Well, I think it's you know, it's hard to imagine today, but New York in those days, one nightclub owner called Rudolph, who owned a club called Danceteria, he once said that there really needed to be two mayors of New York, one for the nightlife and one for the daylife. So you needed a Rudolph Giuliani, and you needed Liza Minnelli should have been the mayor of New York nightlife.
Well, what did you like about the scene, and what, if anything, made you very uncomfortable about it?
I think what was immediately attractive about the scene was that here were kids with no money who were able to invent themselves and claim a place in the sort of media sphere. They were able to get attention and create spectacle and entertainment out of nothing. And I think that, you know, in some respects they were acting out the American dream.
I mean, they were running around with bedazzlers and glue guns and you know, staple guns, and making a different sort of trash couture outfit every night. And, you know, that was inspiring. And I think Fenton and I were very naive. I mean, for the longest time, we had no idea the role that drugs sort of, you know, how drugs were seeping into the scene. We were sort of standing on the sidelines saying, "Oh my God, look at them. They look fabulous." And meanwhile, you know, bit by bit, you know, they started consuming drugs, and it just overtook the whole scene.
You know, I think what always attracted us to this scene, New York nightlife in the 80s and downtown New York, was it actually was an incredibly creative place. You know, you have, you know, Madonna came out of New York downtown. D-Light came out of New York downtown. RuPaul. I think it's, you know, many, many artists and names. It was a very creative place.
And just one other thing. The other amazing thing about that time that I don't think we've seen since then, it was a youth culture movement. And it was a youth culture movement that was actually authored and owned by youth. I mean, we live in an age now that youth culture is sort of authored by 40 and 50 somethings. There is no youth culture that belongs to the youth. I think it's been so co-opted and marketed, and you know, most adults are busy rejuveniling that. Looking back at that time, it's like, you know, these were kids and they were going a little wild, and that's what kids should do.
My guests are Randy Barbato and Fenton Bailey. Their new movie, Party Monster, is based on the true story of Michael Aleg, who was at the center of downtown Manhattan's club scene in the 80s and is now in prison for murdering his drug dealer, Angel, who was also his friend. Barbato and Bailey made a documentary film about Aleg that was also called Party Monster. The film was made after the murder, 3 months before Aleg's arrest, when rumors were circulating that he was the killer. Here's Aleg in the documentary talking about Angel.
He was a copycat. He was one of those copycats that we hate, and so we killed him. I killed Angel, and that's the kind of thing that gets me in trouble.
I asked Fenton Bailey what he made of Aleg's comments.
When Michael said that, we didn't actually believe him. Michael was going around saying that he had killed Angel, and we thought that no one who actually had committed a murder could possibly run around and say they had without, in pretty short order, being arrested.
I mean, he actually, he would go out to restaurants with the word guilty written on his forehead. And we thought it had to be some elaborate prank. We thought, oh, it's part of, you know, it's part of pre-promotion for some party, an angel will descend from the ceiling. I mean, you know.
That's what we thought. And it sort of did fit that a lot of Michael Aleg's pranks and ideas were sort of off-color and slightly tasteless. So it was clear that Angel had disappeared. And for Michael to say he had murdered him was the typical kind of stunt remark that we expected him to make. So no one was more shocked, actually, when he was arrested a few months later than Randy or myself. And we later asked Michael, we said, Michael, I mean, how come if you had done this thing, you would go around saying that you had? And he said, well, I thought that if I said that, no one believed that I possibly could have. And obviously it worked.
And I should mention, in case anyone is confused, that Angel is the name of the drug dealer who Michael was convicted of killing. And in the party scene, Angel used to wear these big angel wings and even appeared that way once on the Geraldo Rivera show when he was doing a show on the club kids. Michael's good friend and his mentor in fabulousness, James St. James, who's played in the movie by Seth Green, he wrote a book about the party scene and about the Aleg murder. And the book was originally called Disco Bloodbath. Now it's been republished with the same title as your movie, Party Monster. One of the things I find so interesting about this is that you've had a hand in three versions of this story. You did the documentary on the scene and the murder, and then you convinced James St. James to write a book about it. And then, based on the documentary and the book, you've made this theatrical film with actors, Party Monster. Why do you want to keep telling the story?
I suppose as we followed the story, it seemed to get more and more intriguing to us. I mean, you know, we're talking about a central character, two central characters who are locked in this sort of love-hate codependent relationship. And then you've got characters like Angel, who walks around with giant angel wings, dealing drugs in a nightclub that is a church, a deconsecrated church. And his nemesis is a guy called Freeze, who has demonic red hair, wears leather outfits, and has this sort of satanic Fu Manchu. we're not making any of this up. It's all completely real.
Now, when I tell people that the film stars Macaulay Culkin, I always get this like strange look. It stars Macaulay Culkin? Because people know him as the Home Alone kid. I have to say he's terrific in this film. And he's got great features for the film, too, because he has such big features and such expressive ones. He has really big eyes and really full lips. So he has to be very expressive with his face during the film, and he is. And he also looks, I have to say, really great when he's made up, when he's in drag. how did you end up casting what most people would think of as such an unlikely choice?
Well, we wrote the script with Macaulay Culkin in mind for a number of reasons. The first reason was because we thought he's a great actor. Particularly, our favorite film of his was The Good Son. But then we thought, Michael Alig sort of lived to be in the spotlight. Macaulay sort of spent his childhood running away from it. Macaulay has a sort of understanding of celebrity that we felt could really bring added value to the role. And they are, in fact, two, different sides of the same coin. And we talked a lot about this with Mac. Of course, he had retired at the time that we were writing the script, and we became so obsessed with it that we said, well, we're not doing it if Macaulay doesn't do it. And I don't know what made us think that we could persuade him to do this, or that he would come out of retirement at the age of 19 or 18, but. But we just felt that no one else could do this. I mean, he has that angelic. There's something angelic about him, but he can do that sort of devilish grin. And we really needed someone with, that kind of killer charisma that could make you smile as he's peeing in your champagne glass.
Literally.
Literally.
And what was his reaction when you told him about your script, in which he would be portraying a drug-addicted drag queen party monster?
Yeah, Macaulay at first, it took a couple of years, really. But once he was on board...
<work. laughs>
Well, we were in a real fix because there was nobody else who could play this part. So if we couldn't persuade Macaulay, we probably couldn't make the film. So, but once he read the script, he was on board and never had any problem with any of the excesses of the character or what he was asked to do. He just seemed to intuitively understand who Michael Alig was. I mean, Michael Alig is someone who had sort of the fame fever in his blood. And I think Macaulay Culkin was someone who, as a child star, almost from the age he could walk, is someone who knew what that fever was always all about. He'd been at the center of that spotlight. So I think he got it completely.
Now, Seth Green plays Michael Alig's good friend and mentor, James St. James. And James St. James is also the author of the book Party Monster that your movie is partially based on. Seth Green is terrific in this part, which requires him to be both very kind of cynical and funny, but also very vulnerable in his own guarded way. How did you cast Seth Green?
I don't know how we cast Seth Green. I mean, we were huge fans of his, and we'd thought of a couple people, but not seriously, and then he just popped in our minds, and we reached out to him, sent him a script, set up a meeting. We had a meeting with him, and we were blown away. He didn't read for us. We just talked, and he talked about, the thing about everyone in this cast is we wanted great actors, but we wanted really smart people. We wanted smart people who we could collaborate with, because that's the way we work. And, Seth is a smart guy. And in the middle of our first meeting with him, there was this moment where he did a flip of the wrist and did the James St. James laugh. And we were like, oh, my God, that's it. You are James St. James. And he actually helped us persuade Macaulay. Seth James was the first person on board. And Seth Green was the first person on board. And he helped us get the rest of our cast.
I think we kind of cast it a bit. We sort of brought our documentary background to the casting so that we couldn't resist, or we felt it was actually really important to cast people who had some real relationship with these characters. Like, for example, Marilyn Manson playing the transsexual, sadomasochistic dominatrix Christina. Or whether it was... Diana Scarwood playing Michael Alec's mum, because Diana Scarwood was Christina in Mummy Dearest. Or Chloe Sevigny, who actually was a club kid and could understand the Gitsy role because Michael Alec was at first extremely rude to her and never really liked Chloe Sevigny. They sort of had a sort of intense sort of hate-hate relationship. So every kind of role, that someone's got some sort of real-life connection. So that, because I think in a way what we were trying to do was try and connect this underground subculture with the mainstream. And that's why almost all the actors in the movie have some connection with their kind of club, some real vital connection, some bond with their club kid personas that they play.
Now, as we've been describing, you made a documentary based on the same people in the same scene, and then you made this feature film with actors telling the same story. Now, when you watch the two back to back, the documentary has, even at the parties, even at the fabulous parties with everybody, you know, all costumed and dancing, it has that kind of chaotic look that real life tends to have. Whereas the party sequences in the movie really look fabulous. I mean, the colors are great. Every costume is perfect. It's beautifully shot. It's as if you were shooting the party scenes from how they looked in the minds of the people participating in them.
I'm so glad you said that, because that's exactly right.
I mean, we were really fortunate making the feature film that many, many of the players in the film were actual club kids. You know, there's about 1,000 costumes in this film, and a huge chunk of them are authentic. I mean, they were either brought out of, you know, the mothballs were sort of, they were taken out of the box and the mothballs were brushed off and we had the kids put them back on. And also, a lot of club kids showed up in the production office with their glue guns and their bedazzlers and made new costumes for us. So we really, although they were a little bit more polished probably than the original one, so we were lucky enough to really get that sort of level of authenticity. And then we just gave it that sort of Merchant Ivory spin.
often... Or maybe I can even say usually, when theatrical filmmakers make a movie based on a real story, whether it's the story of a war or whether it's a biography, there is always just a lot of explanation about all the liberties they had to take with the theatrical version because, well, you know, real life is just too messy and too complicated, so you have to boil it down and you have to make up scenes and you have to change the truth because that's the way you have to do it. Having made a documentary on the subject already, how much did you feel like you actually took how many liberties do you think you actually needed to take with the story? Watching them both, I'd say your movie seems pretty faithful to your documentary.
I think, in a way, looking at it, the documentary almost worked for us as kind of pre-production or kind of research.
Uh-huh.
And James writing the book also helped that process. So that when we came to make the film, we were completely steeped in every detail and dimension of the story. The greatest liberty we took was to compress events and to cut and paste things. And the rationale for that was that, well, these kids spent most of this time on drugs, and in that state of mind, the passing of time or what day it is or what year it is or even what century you're in or what planet you're on kind of becomes immaterial, becomes very plastic. And so we took a story that is over a span of 10 years and really compressed it to about 2 or 3, even though you're never really sure in the movie what year it is or where you are. And I think in a way, even though it is a movie, funnily enough, we feel that in some respects the movie is more true than the documentary, because we were able to take all these things that were true and compress them and put them into the movie and cut and paste them. I think, though, the difference between a documentary and feature, sometimes they get overplayed. And the thing about the club kids especially was that they'd sort of grown up in the lens of the media. They were addicted to attention, and they were carrying on always as if they were actors in a film. And I think it's funny making documentaries, because increasingly it seems that our subjects are familiar with cameras and lenses. They're used to being on a kind of stage. So, you know, perhaps we're all performing all the time. So, which, you know, makes the difference between real people and actors actually less than we think it is.
You know, a bunch of your films are about people who, they want to be in front of the camera, they want to be celebrities, and they've undergone some kind of intentional self-transformation in order to become the person that they want to be. And that includes your documentary on Andy Warhol, your documentary Party Monster, your documentary on Tammy Faye Baker Messner, The Eyes of Tammy Faye. I'm wondering if, like, you ever went through a period of that, like that yourself, where instead of wanting to be behind the camera, you wanted to be in front of it, and if you went through a period of recreating yourself in a new image.
Well, of course, we never wanted to be stars.
he lied.
No, you know what? I think everybody loves messy celebrities. I think we are certainly obsessed with them. And I think we're obsessed with them, and I think probably everybody is, because secretly, there's a part of everybody that wants to be a star, and there's also a part of everybody that is a mess. I mean, and so when you see those two things come together, when, you know, we're all waiting for J-Lo to lose it. She's too perfect right now, because that... The packaged celebrities who are our sort of gods and goddesses, we love it when they lose it, because that's when they are like us. That's when each day we get up, we have to, like, it's, you know, for most people, it's a big deal to get from the bed to the shower and to get through the day. And we are surrounded by all these, like, manufactured pieces of perfection that somehow, you know, we're supposed to believe truly exists. So when someone like Tammy Faye comes along and, you know, the mascara is running down her face and she's losing it, and she continues to do that, does not edit herself, does, you know, just makes one mistake after the next, I think that's incredibly refreshing.
I love it. You think it's really self-affirming when self-affirming for the public when celebrities fall apart.
Well, you know, I mean, the club kids were sort of, you know, often people said to us, oh, well, you know, why would you make a film about these characters? They're so extreme. But they're not really that extreme, in that I think we can all relate to the fact that we don't always want to get out of bed in the morning and go to work, and we all have to do that. And the whole club kid idea was like, guess what? You don't have to. So I do think that there is a very vital connection between all the famous people and all the fame seekers and wannabes and the rest of us.
So getting back to you both, did you... Sorry.
I'm just avoiding this question.
did you want to be famous and fabulous yourselves, and did you go through a period of transformation?
Yes, yes. We Randy and I, we had a band called the Fabulous Pop-Tarts, and we were called ourselves the Fabulous Pop-Tarts, perhaps knowing that we certainly weren't fabulous. And our bid for pop stardom was remarkably unsuccessful. But it did teach us a few things along the way, and I guess we are just fascinated with fame and celebrity. Because, you know, when Andy Warhol said in the future everyone will be famous for 15 minutes, well, you know, that moment has arrived. But what Andy Warhol didn't point out was how problematic this would be, and how much heartache and misery and upset and shattered dreams, and, you know, how it would all end in tears. Warhol didn't speak about that. And I think that's what we're dealing with right now, you know, from reality television to Mariah Carey's breakdown.
Now, when you started making documentaries and you were carrying around cameras all the time, did you suddenly become really popular because the camera confers celebrity?
Terry, I'm telling you, it does not happen.
Hasn't worked for us. But, you know, I mean, the club kids were interesting because they sussed that if you can't get anyone to pay attention to you, you sort of do it yourself. And that's exactly what they did. You know, they bought their own camcorders. They started their own magazine. They created their own Details magazine, which was the paper of record in New York nightlife, wouldn't write about Michael Alec and the Club Kids. So what did Michael Alec do? He started Project X, his own magazine. They brought their own camcorders. They made their own videotapes. And they sort of, in this way, they sort of pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps.
And in many ways, that is another example of how ahead of their time they were. Because, right now in the entertainment industry, there is a kind of DIY culture, very much do-it-yourself. That's part of what's happening with reality television. And, the Club Kids, making their own magazines and making their own couture, were kind of ahead of the curve on that one.
You were making documentaries about gay related themes for years, and now kind of culture is catching up with not only reality television but gay themed reality television, from Queer Eye to was it Boy Meets Boy?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of this coming together of reality television and gay themes?
The sort of huge popularity of all things gay right now, in a way, isn't surprising, because the nature of pop culture is that it is an insatiable beast, so that all the wacky stuff on the edges and the fringes inevitably drifts towards the center.
Is it somewhat just like slightly irritating that gay is like trendy?
It's a new thing, and pop culture is always about the new thing.
Uh-huh.
It's a complicated thing.
Right,
I mean,
right.
I think the easy answer is it's probably a good thing.
The short answer is it's a
right.
good thing.
Okay. And now, Fenton Bailey, I read in reading a little bit about you guys. I read that when you were growing up, one of your favorite kids was Batman. And I thought, oh, the ambiguously gay duo.
Yeah. Well, for me, little did I know, but not so ambiguously. I had this fixation on Batman and Robin that probably was very... I think my parents were slightly worried about it. And I would become, I don't know what the word is, overstimulated, perhaps, by watching the TV show to such an extent that my parents banned me from watching it. They thought it was because it was in color, and the colors were so rich and vibrant, they thought that was why it was having an adverse effect on this young 6-year-old boy.
Okay, well, one last question. You're now working on a documentary about Deep Throat and its impact on American culture. Deep Throat was the one of the most famous porn films of, was it early 70s?
And, made for a few $1,000s and has grossed $600 million or more.
So why are you examining that?
Well, the short answer is sex. Now, it was a very interesting point in time. Deep Throat came out in 1972, and it was at the sort of the culmination of the sexual and cultural revolution, and it. More people saw Deep Throat than Gone with the Wind. Something was going on, and America really has never been the same since. To be honest with you, we're trying to figure out what it all means. I mean, there's so many levels to the story. It when Deep Throat came out, it was the moment of porno chic, and people were going to the malls to see an X-rated movie. I mean, and now, today, we live in an age where we're surrounded by sexual imagery. But could you imagine going to the local mall to see an X-rated movie? I mean, it's just, it's incomprehensible. And so somehow in exploring the success of that movie, we're hoping to figure out all the answers to all the questions of the age we live in today.
Well, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato wrote and directed the new film Party Monster. It's based in part on a memoir by James St. James, which has just been published in a new edition.